It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 542 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast, another great doubleheader episode. Everything kicks off with my interview with Chris Stevens, the multiple Eisner Award-winning editor-in-chief of Kuroshi Comics. He's also the editor of a 152-page epic about the adventures of a 400-year-old golem that spans from 16th century Europe to the horrors of World War II to modern-day Venice Beach, where the golem becomes entangled in a war between a gang and the police. It's called The Golem of Venice Beach. He's got a huge number of artists and other creators participating in this wonderful project. And it's on Kickstarter right now and will conclude on Friday, July the 1st at 2:59 a.m. Eastern Time. If you haven't pledged yet, be sure to get out there and support this wonderful project. Then everything wraps up with the return of Matt Kint. He recently launched an ambitious boutique imprint with Dark Horse that's called Flux House. And we talk about what's coming from them. One of the first releases is called Mind Management Bootleg, and that's coming soon in July. So be sure to let your comic shop know that you want that book. We talk about how this came to be and what else he's up to. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what both of them have to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode. So let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Chris Stevens, the editor who is a Eisner-nominated editor and has many experiences in comics. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing great, Wayne. Thanks so much for having me on. What a pleasure it is.
It's good to talk with you. Now, let's talk about your involvement in a Kickstarter that's going on right now called The Golem of Venice Beach. You're the editor for that. Why don't you talk a little bit about the project?
Sure thing. So The Golem of Venice Beach is a 152-page original graphic novel that is basically meeting up with an ageless golem at the point in his life where he's starting to question his existence. He's living in sunny Southern California, smack dab in the middle of, you know, eccentric, vividly sort of melange melting pot of Venice Beach. And he gets caught up in his ancestral handler's love affair, which sort of spirals out of control for the handler. And as the golem is going through his own existential crisis, slowly sucks the golem into things. And, you know, by the end of the read, you've gone through a pretty rollicking plot that covers, you know, Jewish mythology and present day, you know, noir stuff. And yeah, it's drawn by a murderer's row of some of the greatest artists in comics history.
Yeah, it looks really great. And then the Kickstarter, of course, is the Golem of Venice Beach is the place to look for it and stuff. Let me read a little bit off of the Kickstarter page. I like his name is Adam, and he's a golem. He was created over 400 years ago, a world away in Eastern Europe. He's a creature of vengeance and destruction, of violence and death, and he lives in Southern California. That's a funny bit. Then it says, Adam spends his days adrift on the sunny boardwalks of Venice Beach. All he wants is release from his lonely existence. His only hope is a clueless Jake Loeb, the sole remaining heir of the golem's creator. And when Jake becomes involved in a mysterious tattooed woman and a drug-dealing death worship cult, things get complicated and dangerous, and it sure sounds that way. It's a really interesting thing that looks really, really good about that. So where did the concept come from? I know you're the editor and not the writer, but maybe you can shed some light on where it came from.
Sure. Hanan Beiser is the creator and writer. And Hanan lives out in Southern California. He's in Los Angeles now, but he lived for, I think, 5 years in Venice Beach back around the late 90s, early 2000s. And it stuck with him. You know, he walked around those streets and he saw how vibrant things were. And it was much different, you know, than what he was used to living back in New York. And having grown up with the Jewish heritage that he grew up with, and now he's out in this sun-drenched place, he starts daydreaming about some of the things from his youth, some of the stuff from his Bible studies, some of the stuff, the stories his grandfather would tell. And he's walking around in the sunlight. It's got nothing to do with, Europe or you know, medieval times or anything. And I think it just came together in his head all of a sudden. And Hanan's background is film. He works as a director and producer for Fox Sports and for NFL Network. And I know, you know, his like we all have our interior goals, and he wants to make comics and make movies and tell his stories. And I think the Golem came together for him, and he spent some time putting it together in a script, a screenplay at first, that wound up winning a screenplay contest out in Hollywood. It was a new contest, and it was the first time they'd used a category for comic books, for graphic novels, and his script won that. And I think that gave him the impetus to actually want to go ahead and get this thing made. And I had just started freelance editing. I had owned my own publishing company, Locust Moon, and I had won some Eisner Awards through that and published about 8 books. A couple of them did very well. A book called Little Nemo, Dream Another Dream, won some Eisner Awards and was an NPR Book of the Year, and had a very successful 6-figure Kickstarter. And I think Hanan had seen that, had seen my freelance. I had posted on Facebook that I was going to be doing freelance editing after I closed my company down. And Hanan was sort of the first job that I took. And, you know, he came in, it was Hanan's vision. He understood where comics was and how hard, sort of what we were talking about, Wayne, before we started taping, just about how much great stuff is out there and how hard it is to get seen. And Hanan was very smart in realizing that an unknown writer, an unknown property, he wanted to make a splash the best he could with great artists. And that was sort of the job he gave me. And, you know, the results are, you know, hopefully everyone's going to see the results now with the Kickstarter being live, and when, you know, later when the book's in people's hands after the Kickstarter fulfills. And, you know, we've got Bill Sienkiewicz and Jay Lee and Paul Pope and Michael and Laura Allred and Nick Patera and Stephen Bissett came out of semi-retirement and swung his brush pretty mightily for us. So, and then Vanessa Cardinale, who I like to call the engine of the book. Vanessa drew the main narrative, and she's on a series for Image right now called Slumber that is on its 3rd issue, I believe. So we've got the great Clem Robbins of 100 Bullets fame and Hellboy universe lettering fame. So it's just a hell of a package that Hanan tasked me to put together. And like you said, the Kickstarter's 3 days in and we're funded, and here we are.
Right, and people get on me because I don't say this soon enough, but the project will be funded if it reaches its goal by Friday, July the 1st at 2:59 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And as we're talking, you've already reached your goal of $20,000 and going beyond that. So that's a lot of congratulations for that. A lot of people would love to meet their goals, and it's great that you already hit it so quickly.
Oh, thank you, Wayne. Well, we have an amazing team in place. We have Superfans Promotions, who has helped out a lot. I haven't done I did just wrap up a really successful crowdfunding campaign on a different platform with my partner, Nick Patera, his Axe Wielder John book. We just wrapped up a very successful campaign about a week ago. But going straight into Kickstarter, I haven't done a Kickstarter campaign since 2016, I think. And Hanan had no experience. So Superfans and David Hyde have been just genius in the promotional work and helping game plan our path ahead. And then the artists have been great in supporting. And you know, the only thing I'll say, you're 100% correct. It is a very blessed and lucky position to be in, to fund in basically a little over 24 hours. The only thing I would say is we're super thankful for the push everyone's given us. And a book like this is incredibly hard to produce. And I'll just be frank, very expensive to produce when you have the caliber of artists that we were able to bring together into the Golem's world. So it would be wonderful. Folks like yourself, readers out there, people who are into comics and like to share stuff, we could use all the help we could get pushing, you know, just because we're funded. It's an incredibly expensive book. It really needs to keep doing well. And shows like you and good people like yourself having me on the chat with you about it is going to be a big help in that direction.
Well, I've already supported it. And I got some questions I'm kind of curious about. It's a big book, and you've got all these different artists and stuff contributing to it. Is this like one continuous story? Do you get the story done, then have all the different chapters that different artists gave? How do you put this together? I mean, how does it if somebody sits down to read it, will it be one continuous story, or will there be the different chapters that go around different places?
Sure, sure, Wayne. So it is, and I'm happy to talk more too about how, in terms of like actually how it was put together and the thought process behind that. We could have some fun talking about that. In terms of your question there about the narrative and how the reader is going to experience it, it is a singular narrative. It opens up. Bill Sienkiewicz, the legend, the master, probably comics' greatest living artist. I don't think too many people would argue that. Bill was kind enough to come on board. We've worked together before and are friends. And he was the first guy I thought of when Hanan told me a bit more about the material. And Bill did the wraparound cover, beautiful museum quality painted wraparound cover. And he did the opening prologue, which is the creation of the Golem in late 16th century Prague. So you open up with Bill Sienkiewicz taking you back in time to the creation of the Golem. And when Bill's scene ends, we cut to Venice Beach, modern day Venice Beach. And Vanessa Cardinale takes you basically on a 100-page journey through the main narrative, through the modern-day narrative. Interspersed throughout the main narrative are two flashback sequences by Jay Lee that detail the Golem's reemergence during World War II. So it's one narrative told by Bill and then by Vanessa, and Jay is interspersed throughout. At the end of the book, you have the material that's built around it. So you have a really gorgeous and evocative spread from Paul Pope that is sort of a character moment between two teenage girls from the book that I don't want to spoil too much, but Izzy and Sasha. And I think they steal every single panel that they're in. They're just a delight to me. And in a perfect world, there would be further adventures of Izzy and Sasha. So we'll see. But Paul's piece that he did with the great colorist Laverne Kinzerski, they did a beautiful beach scene that has the iconic Santa Monica Pier prominently featured. Steve Bissett, who hasn't done much, if any, interior comics in a long, long time, he started off doing one page and got so excited, which I can tell you was the biggest thrill to me and to Hanan. He got so excited, he turned it into a two-page sequential. And we call Steve's a phantasmagoria. I don't know any other better word for it. When people see it, it's being shared quite a bit online with a lot of the amazing press we've gotten from Hollywood Reporter and IGN and stuff like that. So the pages are out there and they're creepy. They're Steve's going to give people nightmares, and that's what Steve does. And what an honor to have probably the greatest living horror artist in the book. You've got Michael Allred, who did a really fantastical, charming map of Venice Beach, where Mike put in all the landmarks and some of the people who, I guess, certainly if you're from that area, are probably sort of like street famous, you know, like, oh, I know that guy. So it's a real kind of like Where's Waldo spread That's going to be in the book. Could be used as end papers. It's a little design element we're going to figure out. What else? Nick Patara, who is my partner in his new label, Kuroshi Comics, and we just wrapped up the Axe Wielder John crowdfunding campaign last week. Nick has done a spread where the second page of his spread is literally every single character who appears in the book, whether they have a speaking part or not. So every character who appears in a panel, Nick has put into this glorious crowd scene. I'm trying to think. I hope I'm not missing anybody. But yeah, so basically it is one narrative, Wayne. The reader is going to go on a journey that spans 400 years. The bulk of it set in present day modern beach. In present day Venice Beach. And then some of the side material is built around it towards the end. Yes.
Okay, because I'm curious. I love a good ending, especially in a story that has a beginning, middle, and end. And so I'm really looking forward to how this is going to wrap up. I'm just fascinated by that.
I can't wait for you to see it. We'll talk again after, and you'll tell me what you think.
Okay, that'll be good. Now, you mentioned about gathering together an illustrious group of artists like this. How did you do that? I mean, did you have a little card catalog where you went through and kind of called people, or how did you get a hold of these people and get them involved?
Sure. So I started off as trying to get into comics as a writer solely. And had some credits, wrote for some anthologies for Image and for Random House, and got an Eisner nomination right out of the gate. And when I got started in comics, my first friends and the first people I worked with were Jay Lee and Arthur Adams and Farrell Dalrymple. And through those guys, over the years, I met a lot of people. And I did own a shop in Philadelphia from 2010 to 2016. And we published our own books. We won 2 Eisner Awards for one of the books, Little Nemo, Dream Another Dream. And we also hosted a festival 4 years in a row where I would bring people like Bill Sienkiewicz into town and David Mack and Paul Pope and Chris Claremont, Dennis Kitchen, a wide range of creators. And so I've had been lucky and blessed to have a long friendship with a lot of different creators. So with Bill, who I started with, Bill, when the task was given to me and I accepted the job and was trying to figure out how to put this book together, The Golem of Venice Beach, Bill was the first guy. And I figured if I could get Bill interested, I was confident that the rest would fall into place. And I knew Bill was the perfect guy to do the prologue, to show us the golem being created. Bill's created such, or Bill's worked on and represented in comics such icons as Santa Claus and Jimi Hendrix and, of course, all the superheroes and, I mean, Moby Dick. So I just thought him doing, the most prominent Jewish mythological character, the Golem, I thought it made a lot of sense. So when Bill said yes to that, us having had a previous relationship, he was in my Little Nemo book. We did a book for the Philadelphia Museum of Art, which was a fairly prestigious project. They commissioned me to make a book called Prometheus Eternal because they were having a Peter Paul Rubens exhibit of Rubens' Prometheus painting. And so we made what I think is the only book ever commissioned by a museum of that caliber. And Bill was the cover artist of that book. So I've had a friendship with Bill for a while. With Jay Lee, Jay is one of my oldest friends in comics. He was already a superstar when I was trying to get started, and he was very kind to me. And we actually have a story that we did together that I wrote and he illustrated that's going to come out at the end of the year. It's going to be campaigned at the end of the year in my own personal book, Pretender, but that's a whole separate thing. I've known a lot. I knew all these artists going into it and had worked with Mike Allred before. I had worked with me and Nick Patara are partners now. Nick came into the Golem towards the end of things, but we're partners now. Vanessa was the only one who was a stranger to me, and I had seen her work online and just said, wow, a narrative like the Golem that is, it's rooted in noir origins and noir at its heart. seems to have a very masculine point of view. And that is what propels these type of stories. But I thought a feminine touch was very important, or it could run the risk of being too one-sided. So Vanessa was really, Vanessa was, I call her the engine, and she really was. Each artist, Wayne, I'm sorry if I'm rambling. Each artist, when I saw the script, I said, okay, we've got World War II flashbacks. That's been done a lot. You know, we've seen supernatural creatures fight Nazis. It's kind of a trope. And I didn't want it to just be, as Hanan had scripted it, the scenes had a gravitas to them, what they were dealing with. I don't want to give it away, but they're dealing with heavy material. And I didn't want it to just be this flat Nazi thing on the page. And Jay is probably, at least for my money, the most elegant comic book artist going. And it just has a real quality of elegance and brings his own weight to everything he does. So I just figured Jay would elevate that material and turn it into what I thought was at the heart of the material. It was really a question of matching everybody up with what they could do to really bring the full picture of this golem's world to life.
So let me ask you, though, and follow up on that. Did you seek out the people based on the part of the story you wanted them to illustrate, or did you get the person involved and then kind of figure, well, they can work on this part of the story? How did you approach that?
It was the former. I had in mind what I hoped would happen. I wanted Bill to do the prologue. I wanted Jay to do the World War II flashbacks. I wanted Paul to do the teenage girls. I tried to, in my mind, match what I saw in the script and have it done by the perfect artist to elevate the material.
Okay, that's great, because I think it's going to work out really well as far as that goes, because I always think that some people get the name and then they kind of stuff them into a story, but I'm encouraged to hear that you actually brought them in specifically to take care of a certain part of the story that would work well for them.
I can tell you a funny story, and I don't think Michael would be offended if he hears it. I call him Mike sometimes. I know Michael is his professional name, but with Mike Allred, we had worked together on the Nemo book. We had gotten chummy, had some phone calls, and he's one of my greatest. I just love his work so much. It meant so much to me in my late teens, early 20s. Not that Mike is a ton older than me, but he got started young and was successful right out of the gate. So his work's been a formative thing to me. And I approached him because I wanted to make this sort of map. And Hanan, if I'm remembering right, some of it's a little blurry, but I'm pretty sure that the map idea might have been Hanan's idea. And Allred just seemed like the perfect guy to do it. And I had a friendly relationship with Mike. He was stoked that we won those Eisners that we won for the Little Nemo book, because he was part of that book. He did a really masterful page involving, his Madman character and Little Nemo, which was just a really beautiful thing. And but when I reached out to him, he turned me down 3 or 4 times. And he just kept sending me a map. And I said, yeah, a map. And we just went back and forth like that. And finally, I was starting to feel like he wasn't going to do it. And I don't just go away. When I believe in something, I try to make it happen. So I believed in it, and I was willing to hear no a couple times. But when I heard no the second or third time, I said, all right, I got to figure this out. And I said, Mike, do you remember the Lord of the Rings books? And he said, of course. I said, you remember the maps in the books? And he's like, yeah. I said, well, that's all we're talking about. It's like, not like that. It's not like, not a topographical map, but just a map of a fantastical place. Don't think of it like you're doing a Google map of Venice Beach. It's a Mike Allred map of Venice Beach with all the fun that entails. Jim Morrison murals and Arnold Schwarzenegger on Muscle Beach and Silverman doing his robotic panhandling street dance and all the wacky characters and locales and hopefully when people see it, I don't know if you've seen it yet, Wayne, I could send it to you after, but it turned out amazing, So
I see it on the Kickstarter page.
Cool.
It's really interesting. It's really great. So that's interesting. I've got some questions about the story, and I don't know whether or not, as the editor, you may or may not be up for answering that. But I'm just so curious about it's Venice Beach, and one of the things in the description says that the golem gets entangled in a war between a gang and the police.
Yes, sir.
That's intriguing to me. That you can't get a lot more modern, particularly today. This is a great story as far as, because we're seeing a lot of discussion about the police and about things like that on the street. So I'm kind of curious. I mean, I don't want to spoil stuff, but how in the world does a golem get involved with a police gang war?
Well, he is living in Venice Beach, and he is in the care of, I think is probably the best way to say it, he lives with his handler, and we get to see some of the backstory. I don't want to reveal it, but we get to see some of the handler, who is an older Jewish man and a concentration camp survivor named Steph, and a really lovable character. I think people are going to fall in love with him and see their own grandparents and their own people in their lives when they come across Steph. He's really a character who stood out for me. But Steph sort of is Adam's keeper, and Steph has a nephew named Jake, who in a way is the co-protagonist of the story. And Jake gets involved with a woman, like what happens in a lot of noir stories. Jake falls for the wrong woman, and doesn't see it until it's too late. So and who knows, he might not see it at all. You know how it is when you're in love. So
right.
All these entanglements spin out of Jake's relationship, and that's where, without giving too much away, that's where the action and the conflict really comes into play, seeing Adam, the golem, being slowly sucked in to this sort of comedy of errors that is Jake's love affair with this mysterious woman, Erica. Well, I don't want to give too much away about it, but it definitely, you're dealing, like you said, it is topical. We've got the police on the streets of a place like Venice Beach that has a, pretty massive homeless problem. And that's an element of the story that I don't want to give away too much, but that comes into play. And yeah, I mean, it's not a good guys versus the police narrative. It certainly has nothing to do with that. But the police, there are a couple detective characters who are main characters or main supporting characters, I guess I should say. And I think it adds a lot of, these stories, you can have the coolest characters in the world. You need the momentum to drive things and keep the reader going and to deliver. All those character moments have to be built around a plot that is compelling and delivers on its premise. And, hopefully when everyone reads this, they're going to see that that happens.
Now, I was looking at the news release, and there's an interesting thing from Vanessa, a quote. She says, the first thing that interested me about the story was a fantastic component. Creating not real characters or worlds like the Golem continues to be one of the parts of the job I enjoy the most. And I looked at Slumber, and she's definitely doing some, it has a lot to do with a dream world and stuff like that. So she's perfect for this one because she likes to draw characters that are extra natural, it seems like. So as far as her stuff, I mean, did you all discuss with her how to approach drawing the golem and stuff like that? Because he's a very unique character visually. So did you guys talk about that, and how did you come to settle on what he looks like?
Sure. Well, I can tell you there, and listeners might get some interest out of this, is we were lucky in that Jay Lee actually designed Adam, the golem. He was the first person to draw him, and he did some designs for me, and it turned out exactly what we were hoping for. Jay's instincts to make him, if when people wind up seeing some of Jay's sketches and process work, there's a sensuousness that he gave Adam that really grounded him as a human, even though his massive size belays the fact that he is not, one of us. He comes off very human. And Vanessa and Bill worked from his model, and so, you know, Paul worked from his model. You know, everybody pretty much worked from Jay's design of Adam, but they made it their own, especially, I mean, you know, Bill's looks a little different than Paul's, and Paul's is a little different than Vanessa's. But Vanessa's the one who inhabits him in the course of the narrative. And she really brings him to life, you know, her body language. And, you know, Vanessa's good. Vanessa's what, if we were talking about baseball, she's a five-tool player. You know, she can, there's not much Vanessa can't do. I think she has a really, she was surrounded by superstars in this book, and she held her own. And I think her future, I know that discovering her work was a big thrill to Bill Sienkiewicz, to Paul Pope, to Nick Patera. They all were talking to me about, wow, who's this new girl? She's fantastic. Like, you know, and pointing out all the strengths in her abilities. So, but as far as the golem, yes, Jay designed the golem. We were very lucky to have an artist like Jay, you know, design the golem, and then everybody sort of just made him their own, based on, you know, what their scenes required.
Now, see, I'm a little confused about the golem based on what I've read about golems in the past.
Sure.
Aren't golems made out of clay initially? Sure. But you're talking about golem, he's human.
He is. Every time
I've seen a golem, it's always been like a clay face like creature.
Well, that's interesting.
So to see him human is a very different take on it. I'm just kind of curious as to how you got to that place.
Well, I think Hanan was really more interested in the soul of this creature, of this personification of revenge, of this protector of the weak. I think Hanan was very much more interested in the soul and exploring what would it actually be to be alive if you were such a being, and what would happen if you started to realize maybe life isn't all it's cut out to be. So I think that approach to it, and not just playing it in the straight up way of a creature of mud and clay with the traditional metal tacked into them, sort of Frankensteinian. I think it's actually a very fresh, modern, and most importantly, soulful approach that I think that's what readers are really going to respond to once people have read the book and start actually seeing what the story is.
Yeah, I'm interested because he's so much taller than everybody else. And then too, he's on Venice Beach, which I assume is a warm place, but he's wearing a hoodie and long pants and stuff. So it looked like if he were more human, I would think that he wouldn't be doing that. So I guess, is that to make him stand out, to let us know that he's not as human as, say, the regular humans? Yeah, or is just that he's gotten so used to it that he can wear those clothes and it doesn't bother him?
Well, there's an element where one of the components of his outfit actually has a sort of a plot point to it. So I don't want to ruin that. But in general, I would say, so he's human in the sense that, yes, he's not a pile. He's not clay face, right? But he's not human like me and you. He's starting to experience some of like the inner pangs that we all go through, but he's not, he's not waking up and putting on his pants and going and getting breakfast and then seeing what his day holds. Like he is a creature with a soul, but that soul is not, he's almost like a little child in a sense. It's not as cut and dry as, just because he's a little more physically like us, it does. Inside, he's not. I don't want to say that he's. You can almost think of him as a bit. I guess if he was human, he would be almost what we would say like almost autistic, or he's removed a little bit from the same things that we would. I don't know if that's making sense, but I think that's the intention.
Okay, because it talks about him being a creature of vengeance and destruction, of violence and death, and yet he's a child on some levels. That's going to be a really interesting contrast to see. And from the drawings, it looks like he's almost twice as tall as most people are.
He is, the thing with him is that he would be a little, he would make, if you're familiar, and I'm guessing you are, Shaquille O'Neal, the famous basketball player.
Right.
Who was just a massive man. He would be, you know, bigger, he'd be a little bigger than Shaq if, you know, that was kind of how we thought about it, you know, like, so you're talking about someone who's like 7'5" and, you know, 400 pounds and, yeah, he's a massive figure. When I say he's childlike, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to spin it the wrong way. He is, you know, he's just not motivated by the things that would motivate people like us. You know, he's a being who has been here and gone through decades, you know, in this sort of there to protect his handlers, but he hasn't had to protect them, you know, for since World War II, basically. So now it's sort of, what has he done? You know, what is he? And I think he starts to think about that when he's sitting on the beautiful sun-drenched beaches of Venice Beach and he's looking out into the ocean. I think it starts to hit him a little. So, you know, instead of saying a child, it might be more appropriate to think of him as just a man who's having sort of an inner awakening, I think, really, is probably a better way to say it. And, you know, just like all of us, when that inner awakening comes, he's trying to figure out, where does he go? What does he do? Who is he? You know, what's the point? You know, and I think everybody can relate to that, you know, on some level.
On some levels, it makes me think of the Iron Giant.
Yeah. You know what? Wayne, that's great. That's, you know, there is some similarities there. I never thought of that. That's fantastic. Yeah. Thank you. That makes a lot of sense.
I'm always interested in characters that have inner conflict. So if he's a being of destruction, but yet he's still discovering who he really is, that's going to be something to see. I mean, that's going to be – there's a lot of potential for growth and a lot of potential for character development. And
you're going to be excited, Wayne. When you get about – let me think. When you get about 35 pages into it, you're going to be seeing exactly what you just talked about. That's really at the crux of the book is exactly what you just said, is this thing that is not created. It was created for protection and for vengeance specifically. I'm saying for protection. I mean, specifically created for vengeance and destruction. And that's not what he's been doing. And that's not what he is. You know, it's not what he really is in his own interior. So right around, it doesn't take too long. Readers and again, I look forward to circling back and you telling me if we did a good job or not.
Okay, I'm curious too, because he's 400 years old. Is he's conscious the whole time? He doesn't sleep at certain points and then come back when he's needed. He's always on a mission, basically.
No, without giving too much away, he has not been awake for the span of the 400 years. There's a period where. And the narrative deals with that. In fact, Bill's pages deal with that. So I don't want to give it away. But readers will see right in the beginning what happens.
Okay, cool. Because see, those are the kinds of things that attract me. When I see conflicts and how a story is built around those, I'm always interested to see how that's going. So I'm really interested to see how all this works. And, you know, how Adam actually functions, you know, around people and how he gets to, I'm going to be so interested to see how it's really, really a fascinating, you know, setup for the story. I think
I can't wait for you to see him interact with these two teenage girls that, and just like we were very lucky in the graciousness of Jay designing the golem, Paul Pope, who I've been friends with for a while and lucky to collaborate with, when possible, we've done a few things together. Paul, who is, you know, probably not anybody would argue that Paul does the best teenage and especially young girl characters in comics. And I asked him, I said, you know, hey, there's these two teenage girls and no one, you know, we're not at the point where anybody's drawn them yet. I said, would you mind designing them? And he was just so awesome about it. I mean, he didn't have to do it. It wasn't really part of his job. And within a couple of days, I could send it to you at the end of this call if you want to check it out. There's a really great design sheet of Izzy and Sasha. And I bring it up because what you just said that you're looking forward to seeing, I can't wait for you to see. the golem interacting with these two young girls. I think you're going to love it based on what you just said. And then there's his relationship with Steph, the older Jewish man who's his ancestral handler, the direct link to his ancestral handler. His relationship with Steph, I think, is very, very relatable. It might be an 80-year-old, 85-year-old concentration camp survivor and an eternal golem. But I think people, fathers and sons and men who have other men in their lives, I think will be able to relate to the scenes that I found to be very touching that Vanessa illustrated and Hanan wrote between the golem and Steph. I think those are very – so I'll be excited for you to see the golem interact. Then there's just some random scenes – not random, but there's scenes where he's with he's on the streets of Venice interacting with – just regular people who aren't necessarily really tied into the plot, So you're gonna get to see him interacting a lot with, let's call it, the real world, and I think you're going to enjoy it.
That's going to be real interesting. At some point, something's going to have to bring out that original purpose of vengeance and stuff like that. But if he's trying to interact with people on a human level, that's going to be a real conflict for him. So I want to see how that happens. I imagine that's going to take place someplace in the story.
It certainly does. And when it does, it's like a lightning bolt. So you'll see what happens.
Oh boy, that's going to be something. See how he reacts and how people around him react. That's going to be really something to see. Really great. It looks like such a fascinating book to dive into, and I can't wait. I love – sometimes I want a longer story so I can get into it. 152 pages, that'll keep my mind occupied for a while. So I'm really thinking that's going to be great. It's going to meet that need really well.
I think you're going to – you'll have a book you can dive into and soak up and then even at the end of the read, which I think is going to be a great night's read for you. Hopefully you're sitting comfortable in your favorite reading chair with a little warm tea or whatever it is you like by your side. And when you get to the end of the narrative, after you've read, this long story, and hopefully you feel like you've taken that journey that great books make you feel like when you get to the end, then you get the little bonus of, here's Paul Pope walking you on the beach, and you feel like you're on that beach. Here's Mike Allred's, bouncing all around, as fun as fun gets map of all these characters you just saw interpreted differently. Now you're seeing them through Mike's eyes. Here's Steve Bissett giving you this really horrific, nightmarish sequence. Here's Nick Patera giving you every character on the page and Nick's inimitable style. So, I think it's going to be a really complete read for people.
Well, one thing, of course, I'm interested in when you do all this world building and you've created this, this whole interesting universe. Is there a possibility? I mean, I love a good ending, but is there a possibility for, say, the Golem of Venice Beach 2?
I would say that, we are very lucky, like we said at the top, Wayne, to have been funded in so quickly in just a little over 24 hours. But a book like this really needs to, have a strong performance. It's not, I'll just be honest, and I'm sure the listeners can appreciate it. A book like this, when you see all those names, it's not easy to put together. It is an expensive endeavor. And I think there are plenty more stories to tell with the Golem and to tell in Venice Beach and with some of these creators and other creators who are, equally great in this world. And we just hope that we get the reaction at the end of the campaign and we'll take it from there. But I definitely think there's plenty of more stories to be told in this world that Hanan created.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I am so anxious to read and see what goes on in this world you guys have built.
I hope people, like you said, we've had a great first couple days, and I just hope it keeps going and people keep sharing. And I hope the buzz keeps building and at the end of it, if it works out right, I would love to encourage Hanan and Vanessa and bring in, bring in some other great artists and see who wants to, are there other stories there to tell? I'm fairly certain there are. So let's hope for that.
Well, that's great. I'm already excited about reading it and enjoying this world. Again, it needs to be – you need to reach its goal because you already have your goal. And we want to see how much more you can get to help make this even, the second one even more possible. It has to be done by Friday, July the 1st at 2:59 a.m. Eastern Time. So you're well on your way to get there, Chris, and I am so excited that this is something that we're going to get to support and we're going to get to read. Do you know when you figure the book will be ready to be for people to get it?
I think the book will be in people's hands, Wayne. Hopefully the guys don't yell at me. I think the answer is early fall.
Okay, that's a good place to go. It'd be just in time for holiday giving and stuff like
that. Oh yeah, it'll definitely be, you know, barring disasters, knock on wood. It will be. I think it's September, October is the plan. So without a doubt, it'll be in people's hands in time for the holidays.
We have to account for paper shortages and stuff like that are going on.
Yeah,
so.
We could do a whole other, I don't think that show would be too interesting for you, but yeah, it's been a nightmare with that stuff. All the stories that your listeners might be hearing or you might've heard, it's a very difficult time just on the practical end of things. But you know what, Wayne, that gives a guy like me a chance to have more time to put together a project like the Golem of Venice Beach with creators like this. It's, you know, trying to get everybody together and get their schedules freed up is one of the hardest parts of putting something like this together. So in the downside to the printing woes, which are very much true, also has a little bit of an upside where, you know, it gives you a little time to maybe enact your plan to the fullest.
Well, that'll give you a little flexibility too. I mean, we hope for the fall, but you know, we'll understand if there's a little delay.
It'll be the fall. I'm not setting anybody up for a delay. We've got a great printer, and we've got a good relationship with them, and so there won't be the material's done. There's nothing, you know, the book was done. It was one of, that's something for your listeners to understand and hopefully be comfortable knowing is that unlike a lot of books that wind up on crowdfunding. That need the money to finish the book. And you don't know, I mean, you've heard the horror stories of some Kickstarters that still haven't fulfilled from, you know, however many years ago. This book is done. This book was done when we launched. You know, this book is in hand. It just needs the support of the readership to, you know, help us really, you know, get the word out and build this thing, like you said, so that maybe there is the potential. Who knows if this book's a hit and everybody's happy and we can keep pushing, you know, who knows? Maybe there would be more Tales of the Golem down the line. That would be a lot of fun. I know I'd be up for trying to make.
It's also a project we love on Kickstarter too, which is a great accomplishment.
Oh yeah, that's great to have Kickstarter support like that. We really, that made us all very happy, and we're very happy to have a platform like Kickstarter that provides an opportunity for an unknown creator to go on and make, you know, over $20,000 in less than a day and a half. So without a platform like Kickstarter, that's just not a reality. And I think the future of comics, while I will always have great love for the companies that built the industry and let us all play in it, I do think the future is moving away from big corporations into the hands of the creators more and more. And I'm looking forward to being a part of that with Nick Patara and Kuroshi Comics, Nick's label that he brought me in as his editor in chief. And we just wrapped up Axe Wielder John, Nick's debut as writer artist. We were very lucky. We made $204,000 on the campaign. I'm not sure if you saw any of it, but we had a lot of success. And you know, Nick's a part of the Golem of Venice Beach, and me and Nick have big plans for the future, and maybe me and you could talk about some of those when the time is right.
That'd be great.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's great to talk again with Matt Kent, who is described as, it's got the New York Times bestselling Harvey Award-winning writer of artists and artist of comics and graphic novels. Your work includes Mind Management, Berserker with Keanu Reeves, ENIAC, which I really enjoyed, and Pistol Whip, which, believe me or not, I have the hardcover of that, and I've yet to read that. I got to sit down and make time to sit and finally read that. How's it going, Matt?
Pretty good. Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
It's good to talk with you. And let's see, lots of change since the last time I got to talk with you. And we want to talk about something that's coming in your... you've got an imprint coming from Dark Horse Comics called Flux House. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I pitched to Dark Horse last year an idea of just doing a line of books that would just be me writing everything and then drawing some of them and then just collaborating with some of the people I've collaborated with in the past, but having total control of not just the story and that kind of thing, which Dark Horse has always been great. Like, I've never had to struggle or fight for, like, you know, this is the story I want to tell. Help, let me tell it. You know, I've never had to have any of those battles. But really, I'm a control freak. So I wanted total control of, like, the production of the books, like, not, you know, just the size of the books, the paper, the production, you know, like how we're going to present them, some of the marketing and everything, just to make these books sort of stand out and be a little bit different. And I felt like I have one of the new iPads, and I started drawing on that, and it's fun. And then I realized there's a bunch of, like, Golden Age comics that are public domain that people post. And so I've been downloading those, and, like, they look amazing on the iPad. Like, the colors are real juicy and bright. And I'm reading, you know, you read modern comics, digital comics too, and they all look so good on the iPad. And it's so easy. Like, you can't beat the convenience of it. All of that to say is that it's made me question why I'm doing comics the way I'm doing them. why are we still doing printed 24 page floppy comics, you know, when you can get it the same size on an iPad and deliver it immediately. And the colors are bright, and, you know, I don't have to put my glasses on. I can zoom in to read it. Mm-hmm. So it really did make me question, you know, why are we doing it the way we're doing it? You know, and then I just looked at the whole process and was like, why am I doing anything the way I'm doing it? You know, is it just out of habit? And I really do feel like some of it was that. It's like, this is how we've always done it. We always do 24 page comics that come out monthly, and, you know, they're a specific size. And I wanted to do something different because I still love print. The thing is, as much as I like the iPad and how it makes the comics look, and I love print. I like the way it smells. I like the way it feels. I like walking by my bookshelf and just looking at the spine of a book and remembering the book, you know, thinking about, oh yeah, that was good, or picking it up and flipping through it. And I think that's something you kind of miss on the iPad, is you're there's a disconnect there from the actual material once you're done with it. Like, you just, it's almost becomes disposable, like the most disposable kind of content, because it's out of sight, out of mind. And a book has weight to it. It has presence. And so I really wanted to focus on making these books. They'll work digitally. And I think some people are like, oh, are they going to be hard to find? Are they going to do, because we've been doing a lot of weird things with Bad Idea that are just, like, kind of odd marketing things. And I was like, we're not doing that. I want, at the end of the day, I want everybody to be able to read it. You know, like, that's, if you can't get your hands on it or read it, then what's the point? You know, so you'll be able to get it in all the formats. But I really wanted you people to get the book and feel like it was something special, you know, pick it up, and the size is a little different. We're working in different sizes. So there's going to be a magazine size, like, sort of harkening back to, like, a Savage sort of Conan or Epic or Heavy Metal. And that sort of format. So we're doing some books that way. And then we're doing some fun things with the covers and the dust jackets and different things that are more interactive. I have, like, a, there's, like, a punch card dust jacket for one of the books, one of the spy books, where when I sign it, I'll punch holes out and then it'll reveal like extra little secret codes, secret messages on the front and back of the book.
Cool.
Things like that, you know, these books aren't just something you read on your iPad and then you go on to the next thing. You know, I want it to be like an experience where you're interacting with the book a little bit. And then when you're done with it, you kind of want it on your good shelf, you know, the one where people see it when they come over.
Right, right. How are you interacting with comic stores as far as doing that? Because, you know, comic stores are very, you know, comic books, they have that space and they don't want to, anything that's different sizes drives them up the wall. Like, for example, Mouse Guard, which is in a different size.
Yeah, yeah.
So many stores, they just don't want to carry it or they don't want to display it because it changes the way that all the books look in the way that they have to put it in a different, you know, it's a square rather than a tall.
Yeah, yeah. No, I totally, that's something I definitely considered. I've been going to Comics Pro. I've been on and off every few years to Comics Pro, and I talked to retailers, and I have heard all the concerns, you know, and every publisher I've ever talked to is like, don't ever do a horizontal book. And it's like, why? and it's like, I get it. It's okay. And honestly, I don't like horizontal books because I don't like holding them. I don't like how the pages turn. Like, I don't like that format as a reader. So don't worry about horizontal books. We're not doing that. But I do. And it's funny because I did have to consider like the market and retailers and different things when coming up with ideas for like how to make the book special, but how to not alienate retailers, you know, because if they're not going to put it on the shelf, then readers aren't going to get it either because they're not going to see it or the retailers won't order it. So
right, right.
You kind of have to thread the needle a little bit. So I felt like we're still going to do traditional size comics for most of the books I'm doing. We're going to do release them monthly, you know, and when they're done, we'll collect them. And so it gets, the collected versions, or it's, you know, that's sky's the limit. I'm going to do, I have one that's like, there's a fur cover, like fake fur cover.
Yeah.
With the crazy dust jackets. I have one, it's going to look like it's the dust jacket's like a paper bag, you know, like it's going to be disguising it. And, we're going to do two sizes for the monthlies, which one is going to be magazine size, which I feel like is a good compromise. I'm like, Savage Sword of Conan, like Epic Magazine, like the, like there's a history and there's a precedent there where like, if you want to get the thing, CDC'd and slabbed or whatever, they make that size, you know? So we're not going so crazy with the size and format where it's going to make it like a pain for retailers to display it, or it's going to be, you're not going to be able to find a place for it in your box, you know, it's going to be a magazine size box.
Yeah, so you mentioned the fur business, and the fur kind of intrigues me. I'm trying to figure how you would do that or what that's going to complement. Is this like an animal story or something?
Yeah, there's a book I'm working on with Tyler Jenkins and Hillary, who I've been working with since Grass Kings. We've worked on Grass Kings together and then Black Badge and then Apache Delivery Service, which came out last year. We're doing a new book. And it's about an evil cat. And here's the thing, is a cat's not really evil. I'm more of a cat person, so I'm not trying to cast cats in evil light here, but I don't want to spoil the story either. So I'm saying evil cat, that's sort of a mythological, sort of based on some Egyptian mythology, but it's modern day and there's a girl that has this cat and does bad things. But the idea is the collected version. So the comics aren't going to have the fur cover because there's literally no way to do it. Like I checked, there's no way to do it. Mm-hmm. But for the hardcover collection, we're going to do like a, it's almost like, I don't know if you remember this book, Pat the Bunny, when you were a kid or if you had a kid, like you, it's like the fur sort of sticks out and you can pat the bunny. Mm-hmm. So we're doing sort of a evil cat Pat the Bunny treatment for the cover. Sort of tie in with that.
Cool. Okay, that'll be something different. Is that also going to be available digitally? I'm just thinking about, you don't want to, take out the digital people, but you want to make it available. You want to have the fun of the real life fur. And I'm sure that's not going to be real life fur. I'm sure it's going to be.
It's fake fur. And we're not going to use cats. I don't hate cats. it's going to be digital, and if I can figure out a way to make the digital version more digital somehow, or make it interesting in a different way, I'm going to do that too. I'm still working on how to do that. But
cool.
The idea is I really want the books to be, I feel like the presentation of the book is part of the story. Like the cover of a book is the first page of the story. It's where the story starts. And I think you have to treat it that way. And the back cover is the last page of the book. And so like, I really want to consider every little part of the book, and make it kind of like an art object and interesting. And then, but also I'm not like, if you're only reading digital or you don't have a comic shop in your town that orders the weird books, I still want you reading the book, at the end of the day, it's all delivery of the story. Right. If you can't get the story, then what's the point,
Right. Right. And I have to say, I appreciate you taking chances and doing things that are different because, you're right in the sense that comics have always done things. And I have heard so many comic shop people tell me, this is the way we've always done it. And they don't want to take chances. They want to, every month we order the same things and we get them in the same sizes and we put them on the shelves. And it's just the same old. But to me, I like Mouse Garden in its strange size, and I like, there have been other books that have been different sizes and I like magazine size. You're right. The larger publication really is fun to be able to interact with. There's a lot of people that don't want to do that. And I'm kind of like, I think that's one of the reasons why I think that the industry is sort of, it's gotten stale in the sense because people don't want to take chances. This is the way we've always done it. We're not going to change the way that we do it. And then, they're shocked when people get bored with it after a while and they stop buying or stop coming to the shop because it's going to be the same every time they get there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what we had to, as creators, as every part of the process of comics, like the people selling it to the people making it, you have to be considerate or consider audience, and you don't want to lose, we don't want to lose audience or just keep the same people that come in every week and buy the same stuff, all the time. I think they're just, people want something new and something different and fun, but you don't know what you want till you see it,
Yeah. Oh, boy, that's me.
I'm the same way. It's like I go in, I'm not looking for anything. I'm just looking for something interesting, and I think it's up to us to sort of provide it. And I think threading that needle of like making it so it's retailers can make money off of it. Like it's profitable for them and not hard to sell, like I think that's part of it. But so like, how do you do that? And that's what I've been trying to figure out. When I was doing Mind Management as a monthly years ago, whatever it was, I don't know what years those were, but I was trying to do that within that. Okay, here's a 24 page comic coming out every month. What can I do different? So I did fake ads. The back covers were weird, and I put stuff in the margins of the book, and the inside front right. cover was something. And then when we collected it, we didn't put any of that stuff in it. So it's like, if you want all of it, you got to buy the monthly, And then, eventually after years passed, I realized that, only the people, 10 years ago, they're the only ones that read some of that stuff I did. So we eventually collected it, but we waited a while. Mm-hmm. But to me, that was the first step. That's the step that got me here, which is, okay, well, how can we, not just within a 24 page monthly comic format, but within the confines of the comic book industry, like how can we do something that will get the monthly reader excited, but we'll maybe draw in some new readers, or we'll get some of these books in more mainstream bookstores for people that don't venture into comic shops, it's like, how do we got to bridge that gap and get new readers and just show the comics how vital and how like alive the medium is. Like it's like one of the youngest storytelling mediums, which is why I got into it. It was like, well, there hasn't been, it hasn't been fully explored yet. So that's part of the fun for me is trying to do that.
I wish you success with it too, because I think we need to be more open-minded. I always find it funny when it's like science fiction people who don't understand science or don't, or aren't interested in doing different things and new things. I'm always like, wow, that kind of defeats the whole point of science fiction is to take chances and go different places and you know, stretch your mind in different ways. And yet some people say, no, I only want this certain kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I don't understand that. I don't get that.
Yeah, no, it's tough, you know, and I think everybody has, you have like your thing, your little comfort food of whatever you take. And I'm the same way. Like here's the thing. All this said, all this highfalutin talk about like production and design and the market and everything. At the end of the day, the books I'm doing are, there's like a horror book about an evil cat. There's one that's about a spy who's doesn't realize he's even a spy. You know, there's one there's a science fiction one about it. Like I can't spoil that one. I did a couple of like high sci-fi books too that are coming out, and so everything is like genre and pulpy, and like there's, you know, like my daughter's reading a book right now and I was like, was there a murder in it? She's like, no, not yet. She's like, the city catches fire, but no murder yet. I was like, well, okay, that's then that's all right. But yeah, I'm guilty of it too. It's like I want a genre, like give me some kind of genre. I don't care what it is, I love them all. Like I like horror, I like crime, I like sci-fi, I like all that, but I want something, you know, even if it's a little slice of life, something or other. Hopefully there's like a murder mystery.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a story guy. I want a good story.
Yeah. Yeah. See, it's funny is like as writing for as long as I have, I don't really read this for the same. I don't read for the same reasons I used to, which I used to read for entertainment when I was like in high school. By the time I got to college, I was like, oh, I was getting ideas from books and getting inspired by that. And then now the older I've gotten, the more, when I read a book, if it's not spurring an idea in me or making me think about something I hadn't thought about, then I'm like, it's just okay. You know, I don't want to be entertained anymore because I'm not really reading for entertainment. I'm reading because I need ideas. I need to get inspired. Mm-hmm. You know, I need to get back to writing. So it's like, well, I need something that makes me excited about that. So, a lot of the stuff I read ends up being like history now because, history is really weird. Mm-hmm. You know, and I do a lot of research and I'm not looking for entertainment as much as I used to.
Well, you know, real life is so strange. We can't imagine the stuff that happens in real life could actually really take place.
Yeah.
And so when we do that and we read, I read real life. I like true crime stuff because I like to figure out who did it and you know, why they did it. Although 90% of the time it's the spouse. You know, I get bored with that.
Yeah. No, it always, that's the sad thing too, is like, it's usually that. And it's like, well, okay. That's kind of depressing after a while. But yeah, you really want like real whodunits, you know, with detectives in real life detectives. That's the last thing they want is a whodunit. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. They want to solve it. Mm-hmm.
But that's what we want. I want a good story. I want to be, you know, I know you're not interested in entertainment currently, but I like to be engaged. I like a story that makes me, now what? What's going to happen next kind of stuff. And I really enjoy that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I still want it and crave that too. But as a creator now, like I've just become so jaded. Like I'm just picking things apart as I watch it, you know, I'm like, oh, okay, this is where they're going, or this is what I would do next, you know, and then they either do that or they do, you know, I'm more excited when they do something that's like, oh, that's not what I would have done. And then, it's like, and then the thing that they didn't do is like, that's to me is where ideas come from. I'm like, oh, you didn't go this way. Mm-hmm. You've gone that way. There's this whole other thing you could have done. And then I have an idea and then I got a little bit of entertainment and then I got an idea out of it.
Cause one guy I know he writes novels based on TV shows. Mm-hmm. And when he can't watch a TV show anymore because he's so busy thinking of ideas, well, I could write a novel about this. But instead of, you know, he doesn't really worry about the entertaining of the show. He's sitting there writing ideas for novels so he can pitch them and write the novel. So, you know, he says, I can't really watch TV anymore.
Yeah, no, it definitely, like, if you're a writer, it tends to sort of ruin your enjoyment of movies, TV, books, comics. You know, mm-hmm. it doesn't ruin it. It just makes it a different experience.
Yeah, well, it's just, I mean, I'm a proofreader by nature, and so when I watch TV, I'll be watching with friends, and the commercial will come on, and I'll go, oh, my gosh, they spelled refrigerator wrong. And my friends will be going like, what? And I can't turn that off, and I think that's a part of writer, too. When you're watching something, it's hard to turn that, you know, the writer part of you off and just enjoy something on the TV. That's a hard thing to do.
Yeah, no, it was funny when I went to go see Top Gun with my friend Brian Hurt, who we share a studio. He does comics mm-hmm. too, and he mostly draws, but he's good at story and everything too. So we get out of Top Gun, and we both really liked it. But then immediately we're like brainstorming like revisions, you know, how we would have expanded something. It's like, I was like, we really liked it, you know, but we're like, oh yeah, but then you could have done this, and then. But it's like, even that kind of movie, we can't get out of there without like rewriting.
We watched the third Matrix film, and a whole bunch of us were science fiction fans. And when we came out, went to the restaurant and to eat afterwards, and all we could do was sit there and discuss, what about this part? And this part was different. Mm-hmm. This should have gone this way, and this could have been this. So we're busy dissecting the movie after we went to see it.
That's the fun to me, you know. I think that's fun, you know. And it's also mm-hmm. you're also like recapping your favorite parts and everything. I do that too, where it's like, oh, that part was great. Mm-hmm. And but then it's like, that part was great. Oh, why did it work? Mm-hmm. How did that work? Mm-hmm. You're always thinking that.
Now, one of the books that you're coming out with is how would you describe it? Mind Management Bootleg. You said that it's a reboot or something like that. How would you describe that book as compared to the original series?
Yeah, it's not a reboot. It's not a sequel. It's not a prequel. It's its own thing. And my idea, when I finished the series, it was 36 issues. And I was like, that's it. You know, I'm never coming back to it. It's a full story. That's exactly what I wanted it to be. But the problem with doing that book for 3 years is like, I can't, now all I do is I think about mind management ideas, and I'm always like, just out of habit, I'm like, mm-hmm. This could be but then there's no outlet for it, because I don't mm-hmm. want to do, I'm not going to go back and do the series again or continue the series in that traditional way. So what I ended up doing over the last few years is I did a book and record. So there's a book and record, you read the comic book and listen to the record, you know, and they sort of interact with each other. And that was a way to get like, do more mind management without relaunching the series, you know. And then I did a couple mini comics that were sort of standalone. I did like a Rezo printed mini comic that used like fluorescent ink, because I wanted to sort of try that production process. And mm-hmm. I did that. And then I did like a Jack Chick sort of mini comic that was like a recruitment comic for mind management. It was fun. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then last year did a board game, which I met some board game guys, Jay and Sen, who are famous for making board games, and they mm-hmm. designed a game, and I did all the art for it, and did like 14 little mini comics that are inside the comic. So that was a way to like sort of scratch my mind management itch. And sort of what I was doing is trying to find different mediums to tell mind management stories in, you know. So mm-hmm. mini comics isn't too far different, book and record isn't that far different, and the board game was the most different thing, you know, because you're definitely interacting with it. And so I thought, I was doing the new, I'm working on the new imprint, and I wanted to, I was like, well, mind management, people seem to like that one, but I don't want to do it in the normal way. Mm-hmm. So I thought it would be fun to do a new series that was standalone. Like, you can have read the old thing, if you read this, you don't need to know anything else. You know, it's like almost representing mind management as a concept again. Mm-hmm. But I thought it would be more fun to have different artists draw each issue, and it's almost like a like I didn't have permission to do it, so, which is where the title comes from. I'm like, oh, this is great. It's like somebody's hijacking mind management, you know, which is on brand for what it is. Mm-hmm. And then every issue has a completely different look to it, but they all sort of tie together. We had extra pages. This is what really happened, is we had extra pages in every issue that I hadn't accounted for. And when I was doing the original series, it was easy. I'm like, I'm literally handling every page. So if there's an inside front cover, I'm writing a story and drawing it, putting it there. Or if there's a back ad, I'm doing that, you know. And there were no ads in the original series unless they were fake ads that tied into the story. So for this one, we had these extra pages that are normally house ads or, you know, traditional stuff. And I was like, wait a second. we can't do that. Like that seems like a normal comic. So I ended up having like another 20 pages to play with. So I wrote and drew a backup story that's going to serialize across the series in the back of the book. But I did it under a pen name. so you won't know that it's me, except I'm blabbing about it. But I wanted to do, I wanted to draw in a different style and I wanted to paint in a different way. And I felt like just using a different name to do it allowed me to, you know, I'm using different brushes and then I pick these bright colors that I never use because I don't like those kind of bright inks that my wife uses. She loves them. And I was like, I was always jealous, but that's not my style. So in a way it allowed me to do something extra weird with art in the back of those books.
Wow. Now, one of the things too, it mentions here in the news release is that the polybagged variant versions will contain a subversive collectible playing card. What's with that? What's subversive?
Yeah. So this is part of the thing is, I don't know the variant. Here's how I feel about variant covers and all that kind of thing is I don't collect comics. Like I buy comics and I read them and I keep them. So I collect them in that way, but I don't collect in a way that's like, oh, I want this variant cover. I need this one that's rare. I don't do that. And I don't think, and like when I was collecting as a fan, that wasn't really a thing or it was just starting to be a thing. I think Valiant had done like chromium covers back in the 90s and then with Image there, or I guess it was it the Amazing Spider-Man, McFarlane's Spider-Man, was it bagged? Was there like a polybag version?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and so like I was working at a shop, and so I was picking up those here or there because it was kind of a new thing. I'm like, oh, I don't know. I guess, is this an investment? Is this going to be my college for my kids or something? I don't know. I was only like 18 years old, so like what? I don't know what I'm doing. So I sort of grew up in that era, and I thought it would be fun to do a polybag thing with variant covers. So there's secret little variant covers that are going to be, it's a surprise because the polybags are, I think they're like fluorescent pink or something. They're really bright. there's just a little cutout that shows the logo. So when you put it on the shelf, you can see the logo and the issue number. And then there's a secret cover. And then what I like about variant covers, I'm going to circle back to the card in a second, but the variant covers, what I like about those, not the collectible part of it. Like I understand that and people are into it. That's fine. But what I like is that it gives, work to, artists, you know, like, so I have friends that do covers or like I have somebody that I really am a fan of, but they don't have time to do a whole comic, you know, like they can do a cover and we get to collaborate, you know, and then they get some paying work and then we get like some art that never would have existed. So I love the variant covers. So that's why I did these. I sort of picked people I was a fan of and got to collaborate with them. But the polybag, I wanted to do playing cards. So they're actual playing cards that you can put in a deck of 52 cards and they work. But they'll work in any deck, you know, they look different on the back, but the idea is you put this card into your deck and you play any game you want, whatever card game you're playing, you put that card in there and it has like an extra rule, couple of rules on the face of it. So, you use that card and you do what it says on the card and then you incorporate it into any any card, any game you're playing. The fun of that is that when you deal it in, like the back is different. So you know that if you're playing, I don't know what you're playing, but if you see the other person holding that card, you know they have it, but there's a couple of things they can do with it. And so now you have this paranoia of like, are they going to use that to do that thing? Or are they not? Or, and then the other person knows, you know, so they're like, well, now they know I have it. I can't hide it. So there's an extra level of like mind management ism stuff in there by using this card. And then the bonus of that is when we did the board game over the summer, we did a Kickstarter. There's playing cards that are coming out too in August. This is a full deck of cards with all new art on all the cards. And every single one of those cards has a rule on it that breaks the game or changes the game. And so you can put this card into that deck too. It'll work there as well.
Cool. Wow. Hence the subversive.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a way to like break any game you're playing or like spice up any game you're playing.
Cool. That's good. Now, you mentioned the fact that you've got four artists this time for the four different issues. Now, I know that you've written and done stuff before where you're not doing the art, so you're used to writing stuff. But with mind management, you've always done the art. Was that a transition for you and how did you pick the artists?
Yeah, it was horrible for the artists. I will say I am usually pretty good at collaborating because it's, you know what I mean? We're creating the thing together, but this is the only time I'd done where I had created it, a thing already. So it sort of existed and I'm like now bringing someone in. But I try to be respectful. I send a lot of like photo reference and a lot of, because a lot of the ideas in mind management are just like, they're hard to express. Like I'm doing the thing in the comic and then when it comes out, it's correct. But like trying to explain it or describe it to someone else to execute is really hard. I had worked with everybody before in some capacity or other. So they kind of trusted me and I try to be super respectful of their, you know, not driving them crazy, and giving them a little leeway, but that was part of it too. Is like, it's called bootleg because I wanted it to be like these artists kind of hijacking this thing and making it their own in some way, as part of the concept for the book and for the series. And so everybody had their own little challenge in their issue. And I think, like Farrell draws the first issue and there's a section in the middle where the guy's getting recruited by mind management and it's just a back and forth, like question, answer, right. Question, answer. And it's like, maybe 20 panels over two pages and artists don't usually like drawing those. It's like, they don't want more than four panels on a page. So, but I sent him the script. I was like, hey, look, I know this is whatever it's in. I'm not asking you to do anything I wouldn't do, but I'm a little crazy when it comes to comics. So, but Farrell's game, he's like, no, he loved it. And it turned out great. Like there's this great back and forth where the eraser's sort of, interviewing this kid and it's like one of my favorite things. And then there's a later scene where there's like I described the guy, there's like some physical training and I was like, he's like it's like Harry Chuck Norris from Fury or whatever the Bruce Lee movie was. And he drew it. He drew him so funny and great. Like it's perfect.
Cool. Because I got to see those pages. They sent those to me, so I got to look at them. Yeah. It's very Keith Giffen-ish in the way that they're laid out that way. He used to do those pages. He would do graphic novels, and he'd have like 20 panels on a page. And I'd be like, oh, my goodness, how am I going to read all this? And you got to take your time going down and make sure you get everything straight.
Yeah, but, yeah. Let's talk about Keith Giffen for a little bit. He's amazing. Like I remember I'd never read Legion of Superheroes until the Great Darkness Saga when they relaunched it and he did the 9-panel grid thing. And I love that so much. Like I didn't know who any of the characters were. They're all out of costume. They're referring to each other by their first names. And it like made you kind of work for it. There's text pages in the back, you know, with like extra world building. And like, I have the whole run. Like I hardcover bound the entire thing because I just love it so much.
It was great. Oh man, I never dreamed it was Darkseid. That was the thing that got me. I was very surprised by that.
Yeah,
So good.
So, okay, you're going to pull out the four individual issues. Are you going to collect them at some point?
Yeah, we'll collect them eventually. You know, that's the whole, I really want to do, I want to satisfy people that like going in and doing the monthly comic thing, because I love doing it too. Like, I love the process. I like designing the books. You know, I like having the little extras in them. There'll be, again, like with the original Mind Management, there'll be things in the monthlies that aren't going to be in the collection, you know, things that just won't work. Like, we're not going to be able to polybag the book, you know. Mm-hmm. We're not putting the little playing card in there, and there'll be extra little stuff like inside covers and maybe extra little story things that won't be in the collection, just to, because I feel like if you're going in every month to pick this thing up, you deserve some kind of extra something. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. And then, but the eventually it will be collected, and
cool. Very cool. I'm looking forward to it, because it's really I think it's going to be interesting to see it not drawn by you. That'll be a transition for me.
It was weird. It was weird for me. It felt a little like dropping your kid off at preschool for the first time. It's like, it's okay. I don't know who's more upset.
Well, it's going to be fun. I mean, how did you feel when you started getting the pages back? Because there's that. I help with an indie comic, and I see the script, but then when you see the pages, it's a new experience, especially if you're doing the artwork normally. You get to see how these other people are playing in your sandbox, and it often gives ideas to writers that they hadn't thought of.
Yeah, no, it's especially when Farrell's pages started coming in, I was like, oh, this is, like, he's better than me. He's better at rendering. He's better at paint. He's better at like perspective. He's better. He's just better. So in that way, I was excited. I was like, oh my God, this is like, it's just like better than I could have done it. You know, like it's different than I would have done it in some places, but it's also like kind of better. Like I was able to step back and look at it as a fan, you know, like, oh, if I was a fan of this, I would love it, you know? And then the same with down the line, like David Rubin's drawing issue, which I've worked with him forever. We have a huge comfort level as far as like storytelling and how we work together. And so I knew he's going to be great. And then I'm going to mention all the artists, but they're all a little different to work with too. And Matt Lesniewski, who's I'd only done one book with, and he's the one, his art is so weird. And like, I think people don't know what to think of it at first, and I was like, I wasn't sure how that was going to work, you know. And when I saw his issue, of course, it works. It's a weird own thing, you know.
Cool.
And I had him design. I was like, I need a meme. We need, in the book, we need like sort of this character that serves as like a meme for the main villain or whatever they're fighting, and then no one could. I kept tasking other people with it. I asked my niece, who works in the studio, as helps me out here. I was like, hey, you're younger. You could come up with a meme. Like, help me come up with a meme for this thing. Mm-hmm. And then she was stumped. And then I think Farrell's a little stumped. And then David's like, it's like, don't bother me with that. and then Jill Thompson painted the last issue. And I was like, I'm not going to bother her. She's a living legend. I'm not going to task her with a meme. But Matt Lesniewski, he nailed this cat, this creepy cat face. Cats came up, but I love cats. And this cat's just funny. He's like a smiling, looks like an Alfred E. Newman type cat, you know. So it's, anyway, he did a great. That was his major contribution, I thought.
Cool, very cool. So when does this actually start? Is this supposed to start in July, right?
Yeah, July. But double check me on that one. I can't be trusted for facts. Let's just say that. I think July.
Well, the release says July, so we'll stick with that. But the thing to do now what people need to do, though, is make sure that their comic stores know that they want it, so that they actually order it and stuff like that. Do you know, unfortunately, this is a fact, have they shown up in like a Diamond previews or anything like that yet?
I'm not sure. I haven't got my Diamond. I haven't got my previews catalog yet, so I don't know if it's in there, but it should be. I think the final order cutoff is, if it's come out in July, I don't know. I'll have to figure out what the date is, but there's still time to order it. And here's the thing I will say, too, is if you, like, part of the reason we do the monthly books is because it's fun. The other part is it helps sustain the books, you know, like it helps get the artists paid monthly. You know, it helps cover artists get paid as we go. And like the monthly comics and those sales actually help make the book happen, you know, and then the collection when it comes out eventually is great, but it's the monthly books that are the most important thing, you know? And that's why if there's a book I like, I make sure I'm going to get the collection also, but I make sure I get the monthlies just to help support it. So if you can do it, you should do that for any book you like, not just this one, but any book that you're a fan of, you know, try to get the monthlies.
Right. If I can divert for just a second, I was curious, and I know you've never say anything bad about it, but working with Keanu Reeves on Berserker.
Yeah.
What was that process like? Because, you know, it's always different. I mean, he's a comics fan, I think, but as far as doing a story with somebody who's, you know, a movie person, that's usually a different thing. Did you take the lead on that? And he provided, I mean, I'm just curious how that process worked.
Yeah, I will say too, it's ongoing. We're writing issue 11 and 12 right now. So it was interesting. I went into it thinking it was going to be a train wreck, or I was thinking I wasn't even going to do it, you know, but Boom asked me to come out and they sort of pitched the idea to me too. They're like, I was like, well, what's the idea? Cause it's happened a couple of times before where like a star wants to do a comic this is the jaded part of it is like, it's like they want to do comics so they can get a movie made. And I was like, I don't want to be involved in that. You know, like I love comics more than anything. That's why I'm doing comics because I love comics. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to just be like the person that writes this thing so a star can get their movie made. And, and I told them that up front. I was like, look, I don't want to be involved in that. And they're like, we know. That's why we asked you though. Because we know you're like that. And I was like, well, yeah, okay. But so I went out there and had a meeting and Keanu actually pitched his idea. He had, because Boom, the way it come about is Boom was like, do you have any comic book ideas? And he's like, I have one idea. And so he pitched the idea to me. And then when Boom pitched me the idea, it sounded like the Eternal Warrior. I was like, well, that kind of already is a thing. Like, you know what I mean? There's been like, Wolverine, there's been different characters that are eternal and they're warriors. And I was like, I don't know. They're like, no, just come out, let him pitch it. And so when I went out and he pitched it to me, there's an extra layer and a twist sort of at the end, which we haven't gotten to yet. We've touched on a little bit in the comics, but we haven't gotten there. But that was the thing where I was like, oh, that's a good twist. That's the thing I didn't know. I didn't think it was going to go there. And now I'm interested in it as a story. And then I saw that he was committed to doing it. And I was like, well, if this is the thing we're actually co-writing, then I'm willing to do it. You know, it's like, if it's a thing where you just tell me this idea and then I have to go write it all on my own. I can already do that. I can go write comics on my own. You know, I don't, if there's nothing here, anyone's going to add to it. If it's just me and then I'm sharing credit, I don't want to do that either, you know? But it wasn't like that. We've been working on this thing for over 2 years. And wow. So we would meet in person and then go over, talk about outline, talk about just like hash out the story, break the story. And then I would write it up. Like I'm definitely typing it all because I'm the fastest typer. So I'm typing up outlines and then we're going over those and then we're breaking it down into pages. And then I'll take a dialogue pass and then he'll take a pass of dialogue and add his spice, you know, and that's how we've been doing like every story arc, the whole series. And then every issue we outline it and then we go over it and go over it again. And we've been doing like, he shot like two movies in the meantime. So we do Zoom calls like when he's not shooting, you know, and just go over a script, go over outlines. And he's been super invested. Like it's definitely a 50-50 thing, you know, like,
wow.
If there's any extra I'm doing, it's that I'm just formatting it into comics so that Ron can draw it. You know, like that's the thing he didn't know when we started was like, well, how do you write, what's the script look like, you know, and how do you break it down? And it was kind of fun to see, like it only took like an issue or two where he's like, oh, you know, we're now he's mentioning page turns, you know, and like panel counts, you know.
Wow.
It didn't take him long to pick that up, you know, and because he's a curious guy and he wants to know how do things work and
cool.
He's smart about it. So it ended up being kind of awesome.
great, because it has some differences to Eternal Warrior type stuff already.
Yeah.
You know, that I really liked. And so I'm curious now. I got to see what the twist is at the end. I'm going to be dying to see that.
Yeah, so it's crazy.
Do you know how many issues you guys are going to do when all is said and done? Or is this still open-ended?
Yeah. 12 issues is kind of what we pitched at the beginning, you know. And so it's 12 issues is what we're sticking to. And I think we're doing issue 12 is going to be like a double-sized. Because we need a little more space. And so we kind of did that with issue one, too, where we were getting into it. And we're like, let's double it. And to Boom's credit, you know, they were allowing us to have that freedom. 12 issues. And then we've talked about doing like some other standalone stories. But we're really just trying to get this main series done first before we sort of start playing around with anything else.
But you wouldn't mind if they turn it into a movie.
Oh yeah, Netflix already bought it, so halfway through. Netflix, so they did that, and I was like, oh okay. Well, I don't mind doing it this way, right? Because we made the comic, like there's things in the comic they're not gonna be able to do. I don't care what movie. I don't even care if it's animated. We're doing some things they won't be able to do because it's in comics, you know. And that's fine with me, you know. It worked out great. It's like, because I'm not naive. Like, I know, like, if he's attached to it, there's going to be interest with movies and TV and that kind of thing. But so that's okay. But I just want to make sure. I've started other projects like this with other filmmakers. We're just talking about the story and idea, and I could tell right away. It's like, oh, we're not talking about the comic now. We're talking about storyboards for a movie. And then I'm not interested in that. I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is never that.
Very cool. Now, of course, you've got, you mentioned the Evil Cat book and Mind Management bootleg. Are there other books that you can talk about, or are we going to have to hang on and get to those? How do we find out what's coming out from Flux House?
Yeah, they're going to slow roll the announcement of the titles. So they've been kind of controlling me in that way where it's like, don't talk about this one. Don't talk about that one yet. But I do, I will say there's four books that are half done. I got one in the can, and then, and over really like the next 2 years, there's going to be something new every month for at least 2 years. We're reprinting an old one of my medium older books, you know, that Dark Horse has never published before, but I got the rights back, so we're doing that one. And then mostly all new stuff. So David, I can tell you the artists I'm working with: David Rubin, Wilfredo Torres, you know, from Bang. And he just got off of Superman. I was waiting for him to be done with Superman so we could do this next thing. So that's gonna be one of them. And those are and David Rubin and Tyler Jenkins. And there's a lot of those we're doing a couple of those like big oversized, not oversized. They're like magazine size. So like picture like Epic Magazine or Heavy Metal, so we're doing some big sci-fi stories with that. And then one other person I don't want to mention, I'm not going to say his name yet, cause that would spoil that too. But yeah, there's like a third sci-fi book magazine sized.
Cool.
So stay tuned.
Pastaways. I want to see that again.
All right. Yeah, I do. I think I have two more books outlined somewhere, but
I love that book. If we want to keep up with what's going on, do you have like social media accounts that people can follow?
Yeah. You can find me. It's Matt Kent on Twitter at Matt Kent. And then I think Instagram is Matt Kent for real with some dots in there. Matt Kent dot, because I forgot my old password, so I had to make a new one. And then Facebook, I'm on there too. But all those places. And reach out to me if there's anybody's curious about it, just reach out, and if I can tell you, I will.
Okay, very good. Well, I'm sure this is going to be a big success. I'm really looking forward to to seeing the bootleg one, because I got this thing, like I said, a couple of pages of it. And I do have to say that really intrigued me. I'm really fascinated as to what's going to happen.
Yeah, thanks. I promise you'll never forget it.
Okay. I like books like that. I like to, oh man, that book was, because the, I always talk about it as a Batman story that I always liked. There was a Grant Morrison wrote it. Mm-hmm. Batman stands, he's pouring a liquid and these Superman level villains show up and they say, okay, we're going to grind your bones to paste. And Batman says, and she says, you got any last words? And he goes, a few. And he goes to describe what's going on. And then he pulls out a match, and it turns out these guys are white Martians, and they're vulnerable to fire. He lights the match and throws it in the gasoline he'd been pouring, and the flames just fire up, and they all go, ah! And Batman takes his fist and puts it in his hand and goes, ready. I remember where I was when I read it. I remember how I felt when I read it. And, you know, that's that kind of stuff. That's why I read comics, that kind of stuff. So
yeah.
I get those good things from you, too. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how those all come to be. It's going to be fun.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.